six zoanthropes sounds incredibly annoying.
Wimpway has finally brought you here. Behold, Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Howdy.
Red Powell.
Hello.
And joining us from all the way in, was it merry old England? John Higdon.
Hi guys, nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. We are the Battle of All Souls podcast. We're going to be talking about Tyranids today on this show. And then in the middle of the show, have a community spotlight segment where we talk a little bit about intro into airbrushing with a very talented artist. And, you know, we're talking about how it's a kind of a good fit for Tyranids potentially. You know, we'll leave that for a hobby segment or maybe for a future show. This is a new Tyranid Codex up for pre-order. Thought we'd bring in the Tyranid expert, Ace Face. From Twisted Dice, Mr. John Higdon.
It's really, really, really good to be here, Paul. So thanks for inviting me on. And yes, I love all things Tyranids. So hopefully I can share a few of my hot takes and first opinions on the new Codex because it is so good.
Well, I think that one of the things that people are going to know right off the bat is, can they play Crusher Stampede once the new Codex comes into effect?
I'm glad you brought that up at the beginning because I thought that was a good one actually to get out of the way because I don't know. I don't know whether you guys have heard anything, but as far as I'm aware at the moment, it's still the jury's out. But I would say I hope for the meta's sake that it's a big fat no and both that and Leviathan go away because if we think we've got a problem at the moment with things like Harlequins and Tau and Custodes, you haven't got anything like what it will be if Crushers allowed with a new Codex. There are some hideous combinations that absolutely are not welcome in the game.
I will heartily echo that sentiment. I do think that it's funny that I believe the parameters that the Nids are built upon are a bit of a silver bullet for the current meta, but the issue is they supersede. They will put themselves on top by silver bulleting. They by default put themselves above the current meta with all the trimmings when you have Crusher and Leviathan included. See, I'm weird, yeah? I'm not sure Crusher without Leviathan is going to be as crazy as it will be with just Leviathan on top of all this stuff. Because just the sheer weight of good stratagems you're going to have if you have Leviathan and this book together is kind of nuts.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I like it that this is going to be a whole new host of High Fleet's probably entering the ecosystem, which is probably exactly what the tendrils want.
That's one of the reasons I want Leviathan to go just as much as Crusher. Some people are just saying they just want Crusher to not be valid, but I want Leviathan as well, because if Leviathan exists, it's going to be the default choice, and it means all the extra good, crazy, juicy, amazing stuff for different High Fleets in this might get overlooked a bit. I'm hearing crazy stuff about like obscure things like Jormungandr. Yeah. It's got some really cool stuff. Hydra's got some really cool stuff for the kind of the first time ever. There's lots of options.
We can start wherever y'all want, you know, because I definitely want to talk about the new stuff and what people can start to get excited about, what they can start to acidically salivate for.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, there.
Thanks, Red.
The acid more. I'll let Ace Face dictate a little bit, but as I think I've started to make a little bit of a segment out of, I pick one data sheet from the new book to point out the sheer glow up that has occurred from one data sheet to the next. For the Eldari Codex, I picked Banshees, Howling Banshees, and I've got a pick for this one that is, I believe, the one of the biggest glow ups we'll see in this book. But I'll leave it for later.
All right. Well, where do you want to start? You want to start with like how to build an army? You want to start with, John, you know, tell us, what are you most excited about?
I mean, I think there's two things that really sort of stand out and give the kind of the codec, the new Tyranids, kind of a bit of their own flavor. The first thing is the way that you not only choose a high fleet, but then have the ability to kind of almost have an inbuilt custom high fleet at the same time, so they all have a secondary special rule, which is like their adaptive trait, And you get to at the beginning of the game, and it's one of them really, really cool factors where you can change it out after you know who's going first. So you can really kind of chop and change it depending on what sort of matchup you're against. And it gives you like loads and loads of flavor. So I think that's probably one of the first things to kind of look at, because
the hyper adaptation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we have now three different kind of trees to choose from. Now, each of the existing hive fleets give you the choice of two of them. So you don't have access to all three of them, but you get access to two. And there's some really, really cool stuff in there.
Let's pick one just as a for instance here, like Hydra, like we're just talking about. The adaptive is add 1 inch to the move characteristic of models with this adaptation. And each time a model with this adaptation makes a consolidation move, it can move up to an additional 3 inches to a maximum of 9. I bet everyone thought I was going to say to a maximum of 6, but to a maximum of 9. Or you can swap the High Fleet's adaptive rule for one of the feed biomorphologies or hunt biomorphologies on page 61. So you can change that for the two tree. One of the two trees you're talking about, and the one I didn't mention, is the lurk. So you got hunt, lurk, or feed that you can switch out as a hyper adaptation.
And there's so many cool little abilities. So just to kind of pick out, you know, just a really, really cool one. You've got plus one to charge. So you've got that's in the hunt abilities. So you can have your whole army with plus one to charge.
And augmented ferocity. Add one of the charge rolls made for units with this adaptation.
Absolutely. And in an army that now, actually, for the first time in a long time, actually hits really, really hard in combat, to have an army-wide plus one to charge is pretty crazy.
Yeah. As we know, Warhammer's won and move, or won and lost when moving one's models. And one of the things that you're always looking for is how to get into close combat faster if you have some assault elements.
Yeah. And then if you enjoyed kind of having the ability to have objective secure or have a little bit more dominance on objectives with your monsters, with your old crusher, now there's one in there in the lurk that gives you all your monsters objective secure, which is crazy powerful, which is the territorial instincts. So that is monster models gain the objective secure, and if they've got more than 10 wounds, they count as 5 models, which is pretty insane. And that, I think, that makes for some quite interesting builds.
Yes, also on the lurk here, unfeeling resilience, synaptic ganglia. I just wanted to say that. I really just wanted an excuse to say synaptic ganglia. You can reroll deny the witch test for units with this adaptation. Each time a psychic power is manifested, this is the second bullet point. Each time a psychic power is manifested by a unit with this adaptation, increase the range of the psychic power by 3. If the psychic power specifies multiple ranges, add 3 to the first range specified in that psychic power only.
So really, really cool flavor, because you don't need to think about these before you hit the table, which gives you the ability to be really, really flexible, which is something that we haven't had before and we haven't really seen. There's some sort of similar stuff in sort of Sisters and Necrons a bit, but it's a really cool dynamic, which I think which is a great addition. The other new thing that Tyranids have got that is very, very cool is they have a new, where we had the synaptic links before, there's a new version of that. There we go, synaptic imperatives. And that's the other kind of the brand new thing for the Codex. So these are abilities that your synapse creatures get, which they are one use only. So you use them at the beginning of the battle round, almost like you would for a litany, and then they last for the whole of the battle round. But they give your synapse creatures like almost a beacon ability that spreads across the board, which is really, really cool.
So these imperative abilities is like they are dependent also upon the creature that's doing it.
Exactly. But they all, what happens is it's a really, again, a very, very unique mechanic, because the rule itself is triggered by the unit. but then all the synapse creatures in the army all gain that ability. So it kind of springs off them. So if you've got, so if we take, for instance, the Hive Tyrant has Relentless Fury. So if you pick this ability at the beginning of the battle round, units within 6 inches of the model, they can declare charges even when they fell back. But that doesn't just work for that Hive Tyrant. That would work for every other synapse creature that's in the army for that turn. So again, it's very, very powerful, but it only lasts for a turn. So you've got to pick when you kind of trigger it for what unit to get the maximum ability from it, because some of them are very, very defensive, some of them are very offensive. So kind of picking the right one at the right time and not blowing what looks like to be the most powerful one too early is kind of key to the battle plan. But again, it's something really new.
It's brand new for Nids. It sounds kind of similar to some of the effects that Sisters have, where you can, you know, have a once per game shut off Invuln aura or something of that, to that effect. I mean, I don't think that I haven't heard any of them that are as powerful as that, but mind you, that is an extremely expensive upgrade.
So a couple things here is that it says specifically, however, while similar in many regards to aura abilities, synaptic imperative abilities are not affected by rules that affect aura's abilities or vice versa. So we may use the term radiate or aura or what have you, but know that they are not aura abilities, because we know there's lots of things in the game that that add to the aura abilities or even turn off aura abilities.
We'll send them off.
Just want to make it clear to the folks we're describing it. We may be using that term, but these are not aura abilities.
So Adam, you're saying that you know that maybe these weren't quite as strong as turn off and invulnerable save.
I haven't heard of any as strong as, I haven't done an exhaustive research.
But Paul, did you want to take a go at the warp shielding?
Warp shielding is Zoanthropes. While the synaptic comparative ability is active for your army, and a friendly hive tendril unit is within 6 inches of a synapse model, monster models in that unit have a 4+ invulnerable save. Models excluding monster models in that unit have a 5+ invulnerable save.
That's pretty good.
So that's an army that basically means that for a turn your whole army is going to have a 4+ or a 5+ invulnerable.
Yeah. Because you'll build that in. You'll build around that. You'll build to get mileage from it.
Yeah. She's pretty strong.
Yeah, and how you activate these. At the start of the battle round, you can select one of the synaptic imperative abilities from a unit from your army. See below. You cannot select a unit synaptic imperative ability if that unit is not on the battlefield or if you have selected that ability earlier in the battle. Until the end of the battle round, the synaptic imperative ability is active for your army, and it is gained by each of the synapse models in your army. The synaptic imperative ability and which synapse units unlock them are found below, and that's when it gives us the chart. So we talked about the Hive Tyrant Relentless Ferocity, and now the Zoanthropes Warp Shielding. There is one for every major model in the army, including Tyranid Warriors.
Yay! Yeah. Quick question for Aceface. Have Tyranid Warriors ever been good?
I've been playing since early 5th edition, and they've not been good in that whole time. And it's the first time now you actually want to put them in the board. To be fair, to give them a little bit of mileage, they have been seeing the board for the last 6 months because you've used them purely for the +1 in the Leviathan. But they've not been good in their own right.
Mm. Yeah, because you have to take some in Crusher Stampede to get your battalions, get your patrols and stuff as well. But yeah, they haven't been like a core piece. I think they are one of the absolute winners of this book. Funnily enough, when I heard gargoyles were going to be in troops as well, a little birdie told me gargoyles might be in the troop slot, I was extremely excited. And I was like, oh, wow, cool. You can play a legitimate just flying circus. You can take flyers, HQs, gargoyles. You can just take flying stuff for the entire army. We can get that flavorful 6th edition savage list. But, you know, it could be an archetype. But then I heard about warriors and I was like, wow, you get a lot of bang for your buck. They're a beautiful platform for applying buffs to. And for the first time, they feel like they'll actually kill things. Because that was my biggest issue. I felt like they were okay durability-wise for the cost, but they just couldn't hit. Like, they couldn't slap anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, now they definitely slap something. They can hit like an absolute ton of bricks. And there are points that are right for what they do as well. When you put them in, they don't feel like you're wasting your points. They really do a job.
Their imperative ability is goaded to slaughter. While this synaptic imperative is ability is active for your army. Each time you make a melee attack, a modified 6 is one additional hit.
Hmm. Which is not too bad.
Yeah, sorry,
not too bad at all.
No. What you said was far more relevant than what I was going to say. I was just going to say I appreciated that layup that Adam had where like they can't slap anything, and then Ace Face closed it down with they definitely slap now, so I appreciate it. And clearly, as Paul, you finished out on sixes, they unmodified sixes, they slap even more,
harder, right? And you're talking about points wise. So we touched on two things there that I don't want to get lost, is that Tyranid Warriors and Gargoyles are both in the troop slot here for the Tyranid Codex.
Yeah, absolutely.
In addition to your staple Hormer and Termagant.
Yeah, and so the Gargoyles are a new introduction to that, because before they were always fast. So it's nice now to have another troops choice, because we did lose Ripper Swarms out of the troops choice. They used to be, they're no longer in that slot. So it's nice to kind of have an addition to choose from. And with the speed of Gargoyles and having fly built in, and you can do quite a lot with them. So they're actually
8 points a model.
Useful. Yeah, very reasonable.
I don't mind that at all. The Tyranny Warriors are base 25. Of course, the Tyranny Warriors are ones that you can customize a bit.
Mm. Can you give us that Tyranny Warriors stat line? Because it's not the one I want to talk about for my glow up, but it is significant, the changes.
Yep. So Tyranny Warriors, movement of 6, weapon skill, ballistic skill 3+, strength 5, toughness 5, 3 wounds, 3 attacks, lead 9 with a 4+ save.
That T5 is huge. That's the kicker. That's what's going to put him over the top for that price point. So you consider a Blade Guard veteran, yeah? It's 35. 10 more points. Sure, you get the invuln, you get the 2+ save, but one less toughness. And I think is it one less attack? They got 3 base. No, they both got 3 base. I think.
Three attack base. Yeah.
Bone sword costs no additional points, as far as I was told. And you can make those guys hit at strength 7 minus 2 damage for 25 points with the same amount of attacks as a Blade Guard vet for 10 points cheaper. And I think it is brilliant.
That is true about the bone sword. And I will say that this, you know, I'm a big fan of Blightlord Terminators. This blows the Blightlord Terminator out of the water in every way.
For the points, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, for the point, yeah.
And the crazy thing with that sword is it doesn't really sort of stop there, because that's how it starts off. But then if you've got adrenal glands on them, that's another +1 strength. And if you happen to take them in Behemoth in the turn that they charge or are charged, that's another strength as well. So you could have these guys coming in with ridiculous strength on them. There's quite a lot of buffing that you can put on the Warriors.
That's what I think they are. They are your buff sponge unit now. You can take one fatty unit of Warriors. I wouldn't, I don't know how much mileage you're going to get from multiple, like, 9-mans or 9 bugs. But, you know, a couple of 3s, a couple of 5s, and one fatty 9 to just pump to the stars feels, like, pretty good to me. And like I said, they all just have a gun as well. They all can just have, like, a heavy bolter or, sorry, it was a death spitter or a...
The death spitter. It's the death spitter. And the big thing with the death spitter has got an additional -1 to its AP. So it used to always be -1. Now it's gone to -2. And that's quite nasty. That makes quite a bit of difference in the new world. So, having a 3-shot strength 5 -2 gun at 24 inches. And on top of the fact that they went up in toughness, they also went up in ballistic skill, which is the same for most of the Tyranid units. We've always been, on the whole, unless it's a very, very dedicated elite shooting unit, majority of the bugs have tended to be ballistic skill 4, and more or less across the board, they've all got a buff up to ballistic skill 3. So, and that's huge, because those death spitters will find their mark a lot more, even without any buffs now. So, they've got a huge, huge, huge boost.
No, I'm digging it. I like the Tyranid Warriors. I like how you can add some shooting element to them. The Tyranid Prime, the synaptic imperative for that, does the same thing as exploding 6s for shooting.
Yeah.
So Yeah, you can. I like how there's versatility in what you can get out of this unit, or even how you can kind of come about building the force as a whole.
Yeah, definitely.
We've talked a little bit about Synapse in this. I don't know if you want to maybe spend just a couple of moments talking about Synaptic Link and how those, like what it actually matters for Tyranids.
Yeah, so really cool. So people that got a little bit used to it from the old Synaptic Links in the Leviathan book will have a rough idea of how it works. So West, most people just have either an aura or a range that things, that abilities and buffs work. So West previously with Synapse creatures, they had a quite a large range. So they were like an 18-inch or a 12-inch Synapse range. Everything now is a range of six, but what you can do now is you can overlap those ranges of six to get abilities to actually spread across the board. So as long as that 6 inches overlaps another 6 inches, your range can almost be infinite for a lot of the abilities. And that is the same for psychic powers, which is a huge thing, because it means that quite a lot of the time people won't be able to deny your powers, because the psyker that's actually casting it may well be right at the back of the board and he synaptic linked that power right up into the danger zone. So wow. Some of the powers where you really needed to get them off before, now you can make them almost undeniable. So there's some really good kind of synergy and some clever ways that you can make this new ability really work for you. And I don't think there's anything else like it in the game, which is another nice little thing for Tyranids.
About to say, this is your skill check ability. This is like, if you are able to plan this out, daisy chain your abilities to get like the maximum frontage on your mortals or your debuffs or your buffs, like you're just gonna get like a whole new level of power from this book.
Yeah, it's so good. But you're absolutely right, because that isn't a huge, it's not a huge bubble unless you play it quite cleverly. You can quite easily lose that and find you suddenly sort of standing out in the open with no buffs, or the psychic power's not going to work, or whatever it is. So yeah, you have to kind of, it is a bit of a test of player skill and kind of managing your army. But when it works, it's so powerful.
No, hey, Adam, you want to reveal what you think your most improved?
So in many of these recent codexes, we have been finding that the previous worst thing in the book is now one of the best things in the book. So case in point is, wardens for custodes. You'd never seen a warden before, like the kilted custody guard with the axe. All the custody players have the models, never saw them in any armies because they just didn't have any purpose. They weren't troops, and they were virtually the same as the troops, but didn't have OPSEC. They did have OPSEC, but they didn't feel your minimum battalion requirements to get your better slots, as in your Virtus Praetors, your Caladius tanks, your Telamons, your Aquilan and Galatus dreads or whatever from Forgeworld or Venatari. And so you just never saw them. And so, but now, you know, G-Dub went in there and like, oh, well, what was horrible and nobody took, let's make it good. In this one, there's one unit that was too good that they've nerfed, and we all knew this was going to come because Hive Guard were far too powerful. Now Hive Guard are good without being insane, and I'm not sure they're going to have a place, but we'll see. The Maliceptor needs to be unpacked.
It took me a minute. I'm like, have I ever seen a Maliceptor before?
I've seen one here or there because it had a very good debuff. It had a minus one strength aura that it would give out to, you know, it was extremely good in the indirect battle. Like your Hive Guard would be minus one strength if you tried to shoot them with your strength five guns, your strength six guns, you know, from line of sight, especially when you've got Night Spinners that used to be strength seven and Shadow Wears were strength six and stuff. It made a big difference in a bunch of those interactions. Or taking Manticores from wounding on twos to threes and things like that, and a bunch of others. But now that thing is a powerhouse. People are telling me, I mean, they've had some interactions with this book and they've been looking over it, and they're saying it's not unrealistic for this thing to put out 15 mortal wounds a turn, a psychic phase by itself, single. And if you plan it appropriately, like Ace Face was saying, it can be doing all of these things from out of range of reprisal or range of Deny the Witch, or, you know, your 4+ turn off auras or your Collectus Assassin, which I'm like, oh my God, do I actually need to start bringing that again? Because this guy is ridiculous. On top of, I think, Zoanthropes are another really good option. But yeah, please give us the data sheet rundown of the Maliceptor as it stands right now, and I'll tell you what it used to be.
Sure. It's toughness 8 with 15 wounds.
Yeah.
So it has massive scything talons, which are, decent. So, but it's only got two or three attacks. It does have a Synapse Shadow of the Warp, which we haven't talked about what we can. In Seraphic Diffusion, this unit can attempt to perform the following psychic action. In your psychic phase, a psyker can attempt to perform the psychic action. If completed until the start of your next phase, a psyker gains the following ability, Diffusion Aura, or Diffusion Field, which is an aura. While friendly high fleet units are within 6 inches of the psyker, each time a ranged attack is made against that unit, subtract one from the strength characteristic of the attack, just like we're talking about.
Yep.
Death Throes, when the model is destroyed, on a 6+, it explodes, D3 mortals, has a 4+ invulnerable with a psychic barrier, and then psychic overload. Each time this model successfully manifests a psychic power or completes a psychic action, if the result of the psychic test was 7 or more, after resolving the psychic power, the closest enemy unit within 12 inches suffers the number of mortal wounds shown in the table below. And it's based on the wounds remaining of the Malceptor. So 8+ wounds, the target unit suffers 3 mortal wounds.
I'm sure Aceface will back this up. There are ways and means to make that guy cast 3 spells a turn. As in pulse out 3 times, possibly, with that. And at the top bracket, it's 3 mortal wounds per instance. And so there's 9 mortal wounds just to the closest target. And then you're also possibly smiting, screaming, a bunch of other psychic powers. This thing is going to be a thing to be feared. But just to point out, how many points is it in the back of that book, mate?
I'm going right now.
I believe it's 170, if I'm not mistaken. Yes.
It's 170 right now in the current rules, as in prior to this codex.
Yeah.
And for the same points, you get an extra toughness, you get 3 extra wounds, and you go from being pretty much a psychic joke with a bit of jank, to possibly the best psychic unit in the game.
A lot of mortal wounds. I like it that it just kind of incidentally does them. But it's only 12 inches. You got to be close.
Yeah, but it doesn't. It's not slow. And the other thing that doesn't obviously say on the data slate is its synaptic imperative is incredible as well. So its synaptic imperative means that the unit within range, obviously including itself, can perform an action even if it's shot or fell back. And then on top of that, if the unit is a psyker, performed a psychic action, then it can also do a psychic power as well. And this goes on to what Adam was saying. So, so if it does its ability, so it does its right, I'm going to make everything -1 strength, which is its psychic action. If it's also used its psychic imperative, then it can do that action. That means then you're the closest enemy unit is taking 3 mortal wounds, and then it can do a psychic power or 2 psychic powers, in fact. And then that's another 6 mortal wounds. So, these are the ones you probably want to be aware of, because it's probably up there in the top 3 units in the book. And it is incredibly destructive.
I like how it can dig itself out of close combat.
That's another thing as well. You can't just go and tag it. Like, are you tagging it with? That's going to be able to cop 15 mortal wounds and not care,
And also, it's only got 3 attacks, but it could be dishing out 2d3 damage at -4 save,
It's true.
I mean,
you run a character in there, and you swing and you miss because it's toughness 8 with a 4+ invul, and just one attack gets through out of its 3, and you can just squish a captain.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I think Zoanthropes, I think you pointed them out, and I definitely think that they need to be highlighted, because they this army, I would say, as much as I think one of the biggest highlights of it is, and one of the reasons I love it the most, is because you can play it in any style you want. It shoots really well, it fights really well, it does really good psychic powers. But I think a lot of the players that want to kind of really eke out the most powerful builds will go straight to psychic, because you can dish out so many mortal wounds with this army. It's a little bit obscene, it's probably a reason why Harlequins, maybe top at the moment, but one thing Harlequins don't like is being thrown a load of mortal wounds.
exactly what I meant about the silver bullet to the meta. They'll just go straight through them.
Yeah. So the Zoanthropes now, they've got an ability where you get to add 1 to their cast for each model in the unit.
Wait a second, John. Let's not give it all away. we're going to take a quick break. Then we'll talk with Caleb for a little bit. Then we'll come back and talk about Zoanthropes.
Doom of Malentai.
And the Doom. Yeah. We'll see y'all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a community spotlight segment here on Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined by Caleb Weisenbach.
How you doing?
Yo man, thanks for joining me from CK Studios, from the US Open Tournament Series for Games Workshop. You're all over the place. Got some amazing stuff.
Yeah, we got a pretty busy year coming up. We're really looking forward to it.
Well, look, I've seen, of course, familiar with your stuff. I'll put a link in the show notes for anybody who may not be familiar with your stuff. But you paint amazingly well, and you also do classes. And one of the things we do on this show is a hobby segment where we talk about like quick tips, like things that take 5 or so minutes, but really improve or just explode the coolnessness of models. And you've taught me some things over the last few months, and I wanted to have you on to talk about it a little bit.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love talking quick tips and just, you know, trying to expand the hobby. That's what we're all about over at CK Studios, is just you know, increasing the community, increasing the hobby.
Well, I think folks may know you is doing a lot of airbrush work.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what we're primarily known as, is airbrush artists. Yeah, that's definitely pushing our classes and stuff like that.
Well, it's just a technique, right? I mean, it's just something to use in your, like in your quiver, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another tool, and that's, you know, that's what we teach. That's what we push, you know, is using the airbrushes, just, you know, another tool, another technique, another way to get things accomplished. The benefit, I guess, or the magic of the airbrush, if you call it, is just speed, right? It's getting stuff done quicker. I mean, creating quicker blends or smoothing out sections or getting a base coat down, creating quick shadows, kind of cleaning up little messes, you know, things like that. So yeah, the airbrush, we pretty much just preach, it's all about speeding up your painting process.
I know airbrush is kind of like a barrier to entry for a lot of folks, and I don't blame them either. It's like, well, I got these brushes, they're easy, they're at my hobby store, and I don't necessarily want to get invested in an airbrush, an airbrush holder, an air compressor, special paints, or whatever. Like, how do you ease people into it?
Oh man, that's a tough question, because yeah, you're right. There is definitely a price barrier there. You know, you kind of get what you pay for. I know a lot of people talk about some of the cheaper Chinese brand airbrushes, and a lot of people encourage new painters to like buy something really cheap and don't invest into a good airbrush, because you don't know if you're going to like it. You don't know if it's going to work out for you, stuff like that. But in our experience, what we found is, you know, kind of invest in a little bit more quality. You know, you don't have to go get the high end, the top, the best of the best, but it is better to kind of go with a name brand. I mean, you know, if you time it right, you can get a Badger birthday sale. If you come over and talk with us at CK Studios, we can help you out with like a hard-earned Steambeck. You know, if you got that price voucher that you can get at some of the stores, like a Michaels or a Blick or something like that, they have those discount coupons that, you know, you can go pick up an Iwata, you know, or get a Pache or something like that. Kind of tend towards getting a little more of a name brand brush. I mean, in my experience, I shouldn't say I think, but in my experience, they tend to have a little bit better of a first impression of airbrushing, and it tends to go a little better. I'm not saying that it'll be perfect, you know. Man, the airbrush is really about finding that balance between prep and air pressure and airbrush and stuff like that. But yeah, there is definitely a cost barrier there. But the speed, you know, the time saving that you get when you start to introduce the airbrush into your painting will really make up for that. I mean, this hobby in general is not necessarily a cheap hobby to get into.
Oh, so that's true. But, you know, what I try to, you know, at least counsel and guide folks is to be prepared, you know, what you're getting into. Like, heck, even sometimes there's the certain models you can get that have a little bit of complexity to them. And if you just go into it with an open mind and knowing that complexity is there, then you kind of know what you're in for.
Yeah. And it's definitely about, like you said, being prepared. kind of planning out your purchase beforehand and stuff like that. Speaking to some people that have good experience with it and not necessarily just kind of following what the fad is or what, you know, one or two people say, but kind of see some results. And if you get a chance, man, get your hands on as many airbrushes as you can. If you're at some of these different events and there's a vendor there that's got an airbrush, go ask them to try it out, you know, do a little bit of painting with it, see what you really like, and kind of develop from there. We're planning on pretty soon here. I keep threatening to do it. I just haven't gotten through with it yet. But I really want to do like a full getting started series, and it's not going to be brand oriented. I mean, if everybody knows us, we're affiliated with Harder and Steambeck. We're not like paid from them or anything to do it, but they do help sponsor our classes, supply airbrushes and equipment for our classes and stuff like that. So I will be showing it like on Harder and Steambeck, but I don't plan it on being brand specific, more intent specific, like you know, what your intent is, where you want to be, and kind of what products you should buy for what you're looking at doing. And I'm hoping that will kind of demystify it a little bit and maybe make it a little less intense and scary for jumping in airbrushing, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is the first step? Like, so, okay, you've taken the plunge, you've gotten yourself a decent airbrush, you've gotten yourself a serviceable air compressor. How do you get going?
Man, you know, at that point, it's really just getting familiar with your equipment and learning how it works. You know, if you were like me when you started airbrushing, you probably, you know, decided you wanted to airbrush and you got online and, you know, the first question is what airbrush should I get? And you get, I don't know, 9,000 answers for what airbrush you should get. I mean, every person swears that their airbrush is the best airbrush and absolutely get that airbrush. And they're not necessarily wrong. I mean, they've had good results. Most people aren't looking to be malicious. You know, they're not looking to disinform people, but everybody kind of has different experiences with different brushes depending on what's happening. So, you know, like me, you had to wade through all of that and find the right brush. And it did take me a few different brushes before I found brushes that I really preferred. Like my first airbrush I ever had, I bought a really expensive one and I just absolutely destroyed it. Like,
I've got an Iwata Eclipse. That's what I have as my airbrush. And it's been the same. I try to take care of it. I try to clean it really well. And that's a point we can, you know, the maintenance we can talk about after the fact. But it does really well with the Games Workshop paints.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting to say that because kind of for your experience, that was unique. And you said that it did really well with Games Workshop. But then, you know, you'll talk to 10 other people and all of them will say, I can't. I hate Games Workshop. And they'll have the exact same airbrush as you. And they'll say they can't shoot Games Workshop paint. They can only shoot Pro Acryl, or they can only shoot Army Painter. You know, and the reason being is there's so many variations. There's so many elements that go into airbrushing that it makes it difficult to wade through that. And that's the reason there's so many answers when you ask, you know, what air pressure should I be shooting? Again, you're going to get like 5,000 answers for what air pressure you should be shooting. And then if you ask like, what thinner should I use, or what ratio of thinner should I use, things like that, you're going to get a bazillion answers because there's all these little elements that kind of leak through. And what we teach, you know, over at CK Studios is that we teach what we've branded the performance triangle. And the performance triangle pretty much is just a breakdown. We break it down into three portions. The first portion, or element, I guess you'd call, of the triangle is your airbrush, obviously. And by airbrush, we're not talking like brand. We're not saying like it's going to be a Harder and Steambeck, or it's going to be a Patriot 105 from Badger, or the Eclipse, or, you know, but what we're talking about is the nozzle size. And even nozzles, not all nozzle sizes are created the same. You can have a 0.5 from one airbrush and go to a 0.5 with another airbrush. And they'll have totally different results because of the design of the needle, design of the cap, all that stuff. But to take the variation away from that and to make it less like head scratcher, what we just concentrate kind of is like the properties or the attributes of the airbrush, you know, that 0.4, that 0.5 nozzle. If you guys are unsure what I'm talking about, like those listeners, you'll always see a number that's attached with an airbrush. When you're looking at it, it'll say like a 0.5, a 0.4, a 0.2. What that is the size of the nozzle. And really,
that the needle fits through, like it's the actual hole, right?
Right, exactly. It's the hole in the nozzle. And the reason that's so important is that's how much paint the airbrush is going to flow. And it's also going to determine how large of a dot the airbrush sprays. Because the airbrush doesn't paint like a paintbrush puts a layer of paint down. An airbrush actually just sprays little dots. And as those dots build up on top of each other is how you kind of develop a layer of paint. So those dots are very important. And the airbrush does what we call atomize, and that's how the air mixes with the paint, and that's where you get the flow. And
oh, I mean, it's nerdy.
Oh, it's so nerdy. I could go on for hours like talking about just the technical aspects of the airbrush. But when we're talking about the airbrush, we're kind of talking about like how it's going to flow paint. Mainly, that's our biggest worry, but it's kind of like our main focus is how well it's going to spray, right? The larger the nozzle, the easier it's going to spray paint, but it's going to have bigger dots. You're going to have a little less control of the brush. And then like the smaller the nozzle, it's going to spray smaller dots. You might feel like you have more control. We kind of tend to associate that with like how thin of a line you can spray, things like that, right? But that's what we're after is like when we're talking about the performance triangle for the airbrush is how large that dot's going to be. And then the other two sides of the triangle are our air pressure, our PSI. And then the last one is our paint prep. It's actually the consistency of the paint that we're preparing. We're not talking about like, is it an airbrush ready paint or is it like we were talking about earlier, Monument versus Citadel versus Army paint or whatever. But we're mainly talking about the consistency of the paint. And where we find a lot of beginners go wrong with airbrushing is they just want to focus on one portion of it. Their paint's not spraying right, so they're going to just focus on just their air pressure. And I've seen so many people say that, you know, oh, I've got spidering with my brush. Oh, your air pressure is way too high. You got to lower your air pressure. You got to do that, you know. And what we found by teaching the performance triangle is that you know, to keep a triangle balanced, if you move one side of a triangle, you have to adjust the other sides to keep that balance. So when we're talking about, you know, some of the little issues, we don't necessarily just focus on just the air pressure or just my paint prep, but we're going to look at that overall performance on how all three of those interact with each other. And then once you get the understanding of that and kind of how they all work together, you'll be able to jump from almost any airbrush to almost any paint, really. And you don't worry about recipes and you don't worry about PSI, things like that. You kind of get a feel for it and you kind of listen to your airbrush and your airbrush will let you know like kind of where it's at. I know that sounds very complex for people, but it's actually very simple.
Just gotta talk sweet to your airbrush and everything would be fine.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it's just learning that relationship of all three of them together and learning that there is no set air pressure. There is no set ratio for thinning paints. You're going to create those variations. You're going to use those variations in your favor. That's mainly what we teach like in our big airbrush classes and stuff like that. That's the big focus. But the videos that I want to put out, I plan to kind of talk about that a bit more too. And they're going to be free. You know, they're not going to be behind a paywall or any of that stuff. They'll just be open. And we just want to get that information out there to share it. And then, of course, you know, if you end up being at like one of the U.S. Opens and stuff, like we're doing with Games Workshop, you'll be able to get your hands on an airbrush there. And we play a bit in those classes and seminars and stuff, too.
That's awesome. You're going to be in Seattle?
Yes. Yeah. We're doing all the events with you.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it.
Well, listen, that's actually a great segue. If people have not already gotten their tickets yet, they can go and they'll see these things. Not only will they get to hang out maybe with you and I, but they might learn something about painting.
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, come hang out, see some games, maybe play in some games. And when you got free time or downtime, come over and bug us. Come over and do some airbrushing or hang out, whatever.
Well, look, this really is kind of a mystical thing for a lot of, and I don't blame them again, because there's these different barriers. It's a different thing. It's a different skill set. But what I've gotten to learn from you is that, you know, there are ways to make it accessible and to make it a little bit easier if that's something that people are curious about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, like we said, it's just another tool. When you first started miniature painting, probably just using the miniature paints were intimidating and learning, you know, when you first start painting, people tell you got to thin your paints and how to learn how to layer and then how to learn how to blend and, you know, all those different things. The airbrush is the same way.
It's, I base it's, coat. That's what I basically, I can get. And sometimes I can get a highlight. I'm completely like ham fisted with it.
Well, we just got to get you in a CK class and we'll get you. give me a couple hours and I'll get you creating masterpieces with that thing.
Now, I will say that one of the things we talked about before is you've actually had people paint like an orc's face, just the face, in an entry level class.
Yeah. In one of the courses that we teach, one of the weekend courses, we call it our 102, but it's kind of based like, I don't know, I don't want to ramble too long, but our 101 course is just meant to get students comfortable and confident with the airbrush. That's the whole goal of it. Our 102 class is more on learning kind of the limits, or learning that there really isn't limits for the airbrush. And if your listeners are familiar with it, there's a company that makes models called Black Sun, and they make it's called an Orc Rager. It's a 75 millimeter orc, and his mouth's all open. He's got these big fangs and tusks and all this stuff. And the head's probably about the size of a dime. And we tell the students at the beginning of the class that they're going to paint the face, the mouth, the tongue, the teeth, the gums, the gum line. You're gonna define the gum line. You're gonna paint the teeth. You're gonna paint the plaque on the teeth on this head that's the size of a dime with the airbrush. You know, and everybody's really intimidated with it. But by the end of the weekend, when we finally move on to that, to painting that face, you know, they've developed so many skills through the weekend that by the time they get to that head, they're pretty confident in doing it. And some students will, after they finish the face, they decide they're going to try to paint the eyes with the airbrush. So that's always fun. But it shows the accomplishment that you can do and just kind of developing the techniques of the airbrush. That's all it really is developing that that hand-eye coordination.
Well, dude, it's been cool getting to know some of this stuff, seeing how your process is, seeing you actually do the work, like seeing you put this into motion and make it happen. People can also see that same way we have. Come to check us out at these events, man. Caleb, it's been awesome speaking with you. I look forward to hanging out with you in about a month or so.
Oh, absolutely. We'll see you here in, man, I guess just a couple of weeks, actually.
Yeah, just around the corner.
I might have just dated your podcast.
Oh, no. It's going to come out next. Well, they'll know this about 3 weeks in advance. So if they're on the fence about coming or need a little bit extra encouragement to come join us, hopefully this was it.
Yeah, definitely, man. If you have a chance to come to these events, come take a look at them. GW's just, they're I don't know, they're pulling out all the stops on these. They're excellent events.
We'll see you.
All right, we'll see you soon.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
We are back. Please check out our sponsor and Caleb stuff, and come see us at the U.S. Open Series events. Next one is going to be in Seattle. It's going to be awesome. So, Zoanthropes, I know I paused you right there as we were starting to unpack these basically staples. Are they still going to be in the army?
Yeah, I think the Zoanthropes, because as we said at the beginning, with them having that ability to hand out the 4+ invulnerable save or a 5+ to your whole army, I think the Zoanthropes will be almost in every list, even if you go just for a little 3-man. But they've got power outside of that West. They had never had that before. They never had the ability to dish out as much damage. As I was saying, they you get +1 to cast for every model in the unit. And on top of that, you get +1 mortal wound for every model in that unit to a maximum of 3. So the big thing on there is more than the actual mortal wounds, being able to add 1 to it, which isn't that 1 isn't limited. So if you had a unit of 6, it would be +6 to the cast. So what it means is you're going to get those super smites off a lot easier, and you're going to be able to do some massive damage. And then you team that up with the fact that on top of it, you're going to get the 3 extra mortal wounds. If you've got a unit of 3 and above, these guys are going to do some serious mortal wound damage.
Man, a unit of 6 Zoanthropes sounds incredibly annoying. But they have a 4+ invulnerable save by themselves.
They do. That got a little bit of a nerf because they used to be a 3+, but I'm pleased that went to a 4 because it would have been obscene if these guys were running around with a 3+ invulnerable.
And they're 50 points apiece.
Yeah, they're not cheap.
Well, that's not... I actually do think that's a pretty good value for a toughness 5, 4 wound model with a 4 plus invulnerable save that is a psyker that adds plus 1 to every other zoanthrope around it and can smite and does 3 extra mortal wounds.
Look, it is and it isn't.
Okay. So when, Talk me off the ledge.
So they lost the 3 plus invul, but they got toughness 5, which I think is totally fine. Especially the thing is G-Dub's like really removing all the 3 plus invulns apart, aside from like super niche characters, essentially, like special characters. Some of them get 3 pluses. The reason I think 50 is, I think, maybe a little bit overs or just about right. I'm actually quite happy it's 50 points a pop because of how many points you lose when you take a big squad and somebody's just got the right gun. And I'm talking about the right gun. The first one that comes to mind is like a Borkan Riptide will just smoke the whole squad in one shot because they'll spend CP, ignore invulns, and just pick up the all 5 or 6 of them in one go, and you'll feel very silly. But you know, everyone else, like it's extremely good profile. So 50 points is about right. The only issue I have is though, if they run into like a thing they can't navigate, they don't do anything else. They don't shoot. They don't fight. They're quick, but not super speedy. Like you know,
they move 6 inches. A bunch of,
But they fly. They still fly.
They do. Yeah, they have fly.
Yeah, still fly. So they can advance around and still cast powers and stuff. But you know, Sisters of Silence are a problem. Collective Assassins are a problem. Other psychers that get in range and they can't get out of that range. You know, are things like Farseers, etc. Things that are behind thick walls like Wraithguard, or you know, being shielded out.
Nothing's denying anything with a plus 6 to cast.
Yeah, you're not denying them.
But what you're trying to do is just take a couple away. You're just trying to pop 1 or 2 or 3 away from a 5, and then you just ignore them for a bit. Then you just it's fine.
Yeah. Important to mention,
in one go, you need something like a Borkan Riptide or a Storm Surge or something that just ignores invulns to even consider you're going to slap them down in one go.
You're exactly right on that. It will feel pretty silly if you just get that 300 points just put back in the box, you know, or whatever.
Yes.
On turn one. But so that each time the unit manifests the smite psychic power, that's when you add to the mortal wounds.
Yeah.
Each time when the unit attempts to manifest smite or a witch fire, that's when you add plus 1 for the psychic test. So it is specific to a couple different categories for those buffs, but the additional mortal wounds is specifically for smite. The plus to cast is smite or a witch fire in case it comes up.
Well, everybody crack open your books, find out which one of your sub faction has a 5 up against mortal wounds, and see if you like it. See if you like the color scheme. Be necessary. We'll see.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot more wounds coming your way, 100%. And the Neurophrope has ways to support them as well. So you've got ways to buff them from the Neurophrope, as you always have done. So you can really have with a Neurophrope, a unit of Zoanthropes, and the Maliceptor, or two if you're feeling particularly unpleasant. You've got a ball of psychic nastiness coming at your opponent. And definitely something that the meta needs to be pretty aware of, because it's coming your way, coming to a table near you.
We were talking about like what ways to dig out through Harlequins or whatever. What are they not good at mitigating? Mortal wounds was high on that list.
Yeah, definitely. Did you want to talk about any of the other units, or do we want to touch on? I mean, there's definitely one stratagem that I think is probably one of the best stratagems in the game at the moment. So I definitely wanted to.
In our break, you were talking about the Death Leaper being in every single one of your list. So
yeah. Yeah, he's got so many rules. So you might want to go over them, Paul.
All right, it's elite choice. Weapon skill 2+, movement 10, strength 7, toughness 5, 7 wounds, 7 attacks. It has superior chameleon skin. Each time an attack is made against this model, subtract 1 from the attack's hit roll. While the model is receiving the benefits of cover, it cannot be selected as the target of a ranged attack if the attack is more than 12 inches away, and he has a 4+ invulnerable save. That's just in the one bracket there. That's the chameleon skin.
That's just getting started.
Yeah. Next one is it's out there. It's an aura. While an enemy unit is within 6 inches of this model, the enemy unit cannot start to perform an action.
Not bad.
That's pretty good.
On an infiltrating unit, it's awesome.
It's got a bunch more rules. So, inhuman swiftness at the start of the fight phase. If this model is within engagement range of an enemy unit, it can fight first that phase. I don't mind that. Fear the unseen. That's another rule.
This is the best one.
While an enemy unit is within engagement range of the model, the unit cannot be selected for stratagems used by your opponent, and that unit cannot be affected by stratagems used by your opponent when that unit is selected to shoot or fight.
Oh, yeah.
There it is. That's the charity. That's wow. That's the backbreaker.
Yep. Yeah, one more rule. The hidden hunter,
isn't it?
Yeah, during the setup, the model can be in hiding instead of the battlefield. If you do so, then the reinforcement step of one of your movement phases, you can set this model up wholly within 6 inches of any battlefield edge or any terrain feature, and more than 9 inches away from enemy models, or more than 6 inches away from enemy models if this model is set up wholly within your deployment zone. And until the end of your turn, you can reroll charge rolls made for that model.
Pretty good. I was playing with this guy a couple of days ago, and he got charged by the solitaire. Now, to be fair, I still got a little bit lucky, but solitaire, my friend, he dashed him in, and they said, "Oh, so what's this guy's defensive profile?" And so I'm going through the rules just as you just did, and he's still smiling, he's smiling, and then he gets to the bit where no stratagems, and just watch his face drop. As he can't do mortal wounds, and he can't ignore the invulnerable save. And then he fluffed a couple, and their Death Leaper was left on one wound, and then hit him back, got him back to one wound. But then after that, of course, then you hit him with fights first next turn, and goodbye, solitaire. So, yeah, the Death Leaper means business, and he's going to be a real nuisance to navigate. 95 points. And on top of all that, if you give him the Warlord trait, he's also got objective secure and counts as 5 models.
Just because, you know?
Just because.
It wasn't enough. That was a Danos direct data sheet. I'm going to put that. That's Danos direct data sheet. Because it's just, but wait, there's more. If you buy now.
you too can have objective secured and.
Yeah, you can count as 5 models. This guy does something that pretty much nothing else does, which is the no stratagems thing. If you think about the context there, that's a pseudo fights last because you can't interrupt.
Nope.
You can't spend the 2 CP interrupt.
Oh,
so
right.
It's a pseudo fights last. It's, you know, no transhuman. Is it within engagement range?
Yes.
Or is it during the fight phase?
Yeah, within engagement range.
So that's no desperate breakout. So if you if you tri-point somebody, they're just tri-pointed. They can't get out as long as he's part of that tri-point. There's so much to extrapolate from that rule. It makes your head spin.
Yeah. And he's fast. He's so fast. That's the thing. You can't – he's infantry. He's not going to get targeted as well, which is the great thing. So if he sits on an objective and you've got out of line of sight shooting, it can't shoot at him.
You say he's not going to be targeted. It's a character.
Yeah, but even if he's just sitting there on his own, you would normally be able to target him if he didn't have units in front of him, models in front of him, if he was just standing out in the open on an objective in a ruin. But yeah, you can't do that. He can't be targeted.
Because of superior chameleon skin.
Yeah.
Cannot be selected if he's more than 12 inches away.
What I also just love about him is if you're playing against an army like Custodes that can just sweep in and pick him up in combat, you put him in the back of the board, you know, in some matchups, and people can't deep strike and do retrieve Narkman data because you can't do actions within 12 inches. And then you put him, you know, to block out your backfield, and he just holds it down and can't be targeted.
6 inches for the can't perform actions.
Oh, good. Thank God. I was about to say, if it's 12 or 9, this is just crazy. So, yeah.
Hey, he does a lot. I just want to keep it, you know, slightly reined in.
He's good enough.
Good.
you were wanting to mention a stratagem too. I know we're kind of jumping around, but this is a pretty exciting book. I think that the fact that, you know, John, that you're as excited as you are is telling for all High Fleet tendrils out there.
Absolutely. It's got so much depth. That's the thing. I mean, the reality is we the podcast would be about 4 hours if we went through all the good stuff in there, because it's one of the best books I think that I've seen in 9th edition. Now, obviously, I'm massively biased because I love Tyranids, but it's got so much depth in it, which is just a great thing. But I think one of the strat, and this is again, it's a stratagem that's there's a lot of abilities that do similar in other armies, but it has a very unique way of interacting with a lot of the Tyranid units, and the stratagem's called Encircle the Prey. Don't know whether you've got that there, Paul.
I will find it.
It's only one CP as well, so it's super cheap and extremely versatile.
Use this stratagem at the end of your turn. Select one Burrows unit from your unit or a unit that can fly from your army. Remove the unit from the battlefield. In the reinforcement step of your next movement phase, you can select that, set that unit back up anywhere on the battlefield, anywhere that is more than 9 inches away from any enemy models. If the battle ends, your is destroyed or whatever, a unit cannot be selected for the stratagem if it was set up on the battlefield this turn.
So the crazy thing with this is there's a lot of units that either fly or burrow, loads and loads of units. But when we're talking about things like actions, you want to do Stranglehold, because this happens at the end, you can choose when you're going to do this action. So if you've got something like a unit of gargoyles that has advanced onto an objective to make sure that it's claimed it for Stranglehold or whatever it might be, but then it's going to get shot to pieces next turn. One CP, that unit's safe as houses. What we're talking about with the Zonthropes, actually, if they've got themselves in a spot of bother after they've gone and really ripped somebody apart with mortal wounds, they've got fly, spend one CP. Those Zonthropes are safe as anything. Next turn, they're coming down and doing it again. Take out that riptide.
Yep.
It's so good. And, things like Hive Tyrants, there's so much use, so many uses for it that are really, really powerful. It's just one of those ones where it doesn't scream when you first read it. But when you look at the data slates and you look at the units that can make use of this and you look at the punch that can be delivered and realize how tanky Tyranids are now, it's like the best invulnerable save you could ever have.
It's just not being there.
It seems to be a mechanic that's getting a bit of a sprinkle into a couple of the recent books. Bahroth does something quite similar, mm-hmm. except he comes down in the same turn because he's ridiculous.
Are we talking bad about Bahroth?
I wouldn't dare. This dude's incredible.
Because he'll get you. That's why you won't.
Death Leaper has competition because Bahroth is competing for the best single model in the game right now. G-Steel Cult have something similar as well. They have Return to the Shadows.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think the advantage of it is because you just there's so many powerful units and it, because it doesn't, there's no stipulation of they can be in combat, can do whatever, it's a really flexible use of it.
And usually these things are, in four, you don't really have the unit choices in Gene Stealer Cults. Or your three selections of good melee unit that you might use it on, be it Metamorphs, Acolytes, Gene Stealers, or Aberrants now, I'll add. There's not that much versatility, but whereas you're just picking stuff that can burrow or fly, that's two-thirds data sheets in the book, and most of the best ones.
Exactly.
Only Swooping Hawks and Bahroth can do it in Eldari, and only Taraxi can do it for Admech, who have a similar power, and yet this is just so many different options to use them on. Great thing to point out.
About four pages of stratagems. That's an
industry standard amount of stratagems then.
Got the Death Frenzy. That's the one that lets a High Fleet character fight when it's dead, if it has not already fought. It's got that caveat in there. Death Leaper is getting to attack. That's what this book is saying.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very, very cool one. It is called Shardlore. And this is just a really reliable way to get those combat units in. There's been similar versions of it in the last book, but they've cleaned it up a little bit and made it even more reliable. So once you've shot at something in the shooting phase, you can trigger it. And then when a unit charges into that unit, you can roll 3d6, discard the lowest for your charge, which is pretty good and synergizes really nice with the build of where you've got warriors with death spitters or hive tyrants with venom cannons, and then you've got more aggressive units that are bounding up the board. You've got ways to make those charges really reliable, and there's lots of ways in this book to really make charging very, very reliable.
Yeah, technically it says you roll one additional d6. So if there's ever a way to bump your d6 past two, it would just add another d6.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But it's really, really cool. Really cool.
For one CP.
And again, I know we're bouncing all over the place, but we briefly touched about it at the beginning, but I think it's probably worth talking just a little bit about a couple of the actual hive fleets, just their standard ability, because that's another thing that there's a lot of power in. And I know we talked about Leviathan at the beginning, but definitely the standout hive fleet again is Leviathan.
There's adaptive rules for the hive fleet specific, and then there's a specific relic and a specific stratagem and sometimes psychic power. So
yeah,
or maybe
absolutely.
All the time psychic power for all these.
Yeah, they've all got psychic power. Always got psychic power. But yeah, but the Leviathan one, I'm sure you'll put it better, Paul, but basically it's transhuman for all your synapse creatures. It's full synapse. It's full transhuman. And then for any bugs that aren't synapse, you get mini transhuman, so you get can't be wounded on a one or a two, which is again when we're talking about warriors, which is the standout unit that really utilizes this, with all the other the new survivability of a warrior on toughness 5, that's good in itself. There's a stratagem again to make them minus one damage, and then when you slap Leviathan on them to make them transhuman, suddenly you've got a unit that's pretty tough. Again, that's the same with the Zoanthropes. Yes, we're going, oh, they're toughness 5. That Riptide's going to look at them, they're going to go away. Well, actually, now they're Leviathan, and suddenly they're transhuman. That Riptide's only wounding them on 4s. Maybe those Zoanthropes don't go away so quickly. So it's definitely the one that I think is creating the most buzz. There's some really good ones in there, but it definitely is worth noting.
Keep taking the wind out of Adam's Riptide idea.
Sorry, Adam.
Oh, no, it's not an incredible... So it's a fringe thing that we might start to see because of units like Maliceptors, units like Zoanthropes. That just really...
No, 90 vulnerable saves is huge, yeah. for sure. And yeah, Leviathan, it does basically exactly like you described. The synapse, anything synapse ignores, or can't wound them on unmodified 1 to 3.
Which is pretty insane for an army wide rule. And it's not, so I've been looking at building armies that are basically all synapse, because it's quite easy to do that. So you can have an entire army of pure transhuman. And if that isn't scary, I don't know what is, because that's pretty solid. And one of the other things that Leviathan has access to, those high fleet imperatives that we talked about, where you had the 4 plus invulnerable save, whatever it might be you decide to go for, there's a psychic power for Leviathan that allows you to use one a second time. So we've seen this a lot in kind of other armies, where you take one of their abilities that maybe is used from a previous turn, use a stratagem or a power to kind of turn the clock back, or
very
give
strong
an ability that's used.
When you could do that with the Marine Doctrines.
Exactly. So you now have a way of doing pretty much the same for one unit for Tyranids. So you can basically pick one unit, and then that unit is going to get to use its psychic or its imperative again. So, or if it hasn't used it, so it's really, really strong ability.
The stratagem for Leviathan is Combined Assault. Uses a stratagem in the fight phase. Select one enemy unit within engagement range of two or more Leviathan units from your army until the end of the phase. Each time a Leviathan model makes a melee attack against the enemy unit, improve the armor penetration characteristic of that attack by one.
It's not bad.
Now, for one CP, if you're already in that situation, I don't know why you wouldn't use it if you have them.
Yeah, absolutely. And just their standard ability, that their adaptive is the classic reroll one hit per unit, which is great. So it's the same as the Tau, Tau Sept one, so it's good. But then, so that's one of the ones that you can kind of rest on and know that it's there. But then, if you come up against a matchup where you need to kind of change that out, you've got the ability to do that as well. So,
the feed or hunt.
Unfortunately, they don't have the monster objective secure, so they don't. And I think Games Workshop have been really clever with this. So, the middle tree, the lurk tree, in my opinion, contains the strongest abilities. And I think if Leviathan also had access to lurk, there probably wouldn't be a choice. But really, it's good that some of the other high fleets come into it a little bit more if you want to pick that lurk tree. So I think that's quite good play by Games Workshop, because I've been considering some of the others like Behemoth or Gorgon or Hydra, because I really like the idea of still having a monster heavy army that is all objective secure. I think that's really, really fun. So, you know, you can lean into Carnifexes, have a whole horde of Carnifexes, and every single one of them is objective secure. That sounds like a lot of fun.
So what do y'all think? I mean, I know we're just scratching the surface here, but what is a Tyranid army going to look like once this codex hits?
Literally, just about every codex has come out in 2022. Whatever you want, you can make it work. Like the internal balance on these codexes is so phenomenal. External balance is a different discussion. But the internal balance of the codexes, how well you can build into a multitude of different armies is absolutely incredible. I do believe that there are some things that are very, very, very strong. Firstly, the fact that, you know, Tyrant Guard, Bodyguard for Hive Tyrants. I mean, it's in the name, Tyrant Guard, Hive Tyrants. And as long as that rule remains, you are going to see, just like you see one unit of Wardens in every list, you're going to see one unit of Tyrant Guard in every list. I think you're going to see a big brick of Warriors and then some MSU Warriors, and then maybe if people want to, one big unit of Hormigants. And then it's pick your poison. To me, it's one big unit of Zoanthropes, one Maliceptor, a Death Leaper, and then just whichever. Take your selection. Do you want beef? If you want beef, maybe there's some Carnifexes that scratch your itch. Maybe even the hallowed and much maligned Haru Specs, who I don't mind at the moment, but I don't think he quite makes the cut. I think it's just medium bugs and spamming as many of them as you feel fit. Raveners are in a good place now as well, so I wouldn't be surprised if we see them. How far off the mark am I, Aceface?
No, I think you're pretty much spot on. I wouldn't add a lot to that. I think one of the great things about it is it rewards you by playing, I think, a variety of different types of unit within your army. I've always thought that benefits Tyranids, where you can have almost layers that you bring across the board. So you've got your psychic, you've got your shooting, you've got your aggressive kind of board control. When you have a bit of everything, I think it really works quite well, and you plan that synergy across it. It does mean that it's a harder army to play when you play it that way, because it's easy to lean into one of the three styles. So you could go all horde, all shooting, all combat or psychic even now. But I think actually building something with a bit of everything actually will probably be the way that eventually becomes the way to play. But I think the standouts are exactly. I think you're always going to see a tyrant, whether that's on foot or with wings. You can only have one now per detachment, but I think they're so good, potentially it's worth taking a patrol to get a second one, because they're that good. I think the Tyrant Guard are definitely a good shout. I think Warriors over any of the little bugs, possibly Gargoyles, but it'll be Warriors and Gargoyles. I don't see Termagants or Hormigaunts at first, but they're still great. And then, as you said, all the kind of the elite-y medium bugs in the elite and fast. So the Raveners, the Zoanthropes are amazing. And then you just sprinkle in whatever heavy lifters you want. You mentioned some. I love the Tyrannifex. I think the Flamer got even better. It's another way to absolutely destroy Harlequins if they continue to be a menace. Because it's not just a Flamer, it's a long-range Flamer. It's an 18-inch Flamer on a unit that moves relatively quickly. And the Flyers, whereas before the Harpy was an absolute joke, now you can have something that's flying around with two heavy Venom Cannons that shoots reliably, that's fast, that's a little bit more tanky, and can actually do lots of jobs as well. So I think you've got a bit of a stable middle ground, but then what you decide to kind of add on is just going to be what your kind of preference is. But there's loads of options.
I have one more unit that I want to talk about, because I wasn't even sure this unit truly existed. People whispered about this name, and I was like, yeah, but I've never seen one. I don't think they actually exist. I think this is just an in-joke for you Tyranny players, or a delusion. You know, these things happen too. The Star Children, you know, Hypnosis. Pyrovores.
It's been a minute, right?
This is the unit you will... might see, like, you might legitimately see now, because it's like we said, it's one of those medium bugs that comes at a good price point per wound, has two profiles on its flamer now, and guess what, they're both good.
Profile,
don't sleep on the power.
Burning spray, 12 inch assault d6, strength 6, neg 2 ap, 2 damage.
Beautiful.
Automatically hits. And then the pyro gout, 18 inch 2d6 assault, strength 4, neg 1 damage, auto hits.
Yeah, and I think the 5 wounds is huge for it. Having a, you know, it you know, that for me is massive. And the fact that it's now gone up to having a 3-up save. So before it had a 4-up save, and I think it had 4 wounds previously. So just that in itself is just a crazy, crazy boost. They're reasonably pointed, so I absolutely think they're a good shout. It's not one that I've looked at so far because there's just so many choices. Yeah. But
because
they're
on the page right after the Mal Scepter, and so you can't.
Yeah. What? Huh? And I mean, there'd be a whole legion of Tyranny players who'd never even considered it as being a relative option. It was a fringe option in 5th and 6th edition, and then unheard of in 7th, joke in 8th, and the same much maligned in 9th. And now maybe it's their time. Maybe a unit of 3 or a couple of units of 3 or a couple of units of 2. I think a couple of singles is so annoying. A couple of single pyrovores, you're like, toughness 5, 5 wounds and a 3 up. Why do I have to shoot this thing so much? I don't want to. It's doing just enough damage to peeve you. But not so much damage that you're going to tear your hair out to try and kill it. I think they're sitting in a sweet spot.
Representing the opposition, you know, I used to pack one flamer, at least one heavy flamer in every list that I ever took, just in case I came up against a bunch of Hormigons or Termagons. Red,
that's just...
Is one flamer going to do it anymore?
No. I'm sorry.
How are we going to cope, man? We got...
Bring more flamers.
You know?
I'm literally just going to pretend I'm Hudson from Aliens anytime I play Nids.
That's what we all do, isn't it? Everybody in our mind, even when we're playing or playing against, we all think we're either in Aliens or in Starship Troopers. Yep. Like that's how every game goes, right?
How'd they get through the doors, man? They're animals. As they like,
game over, 3D. Man. Game over.
Jeez, that's exactly right. That's the line. Going so down good. By 40 points to Nids. Game over, man.
I do think this codex is pretty good.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, not even pulling the zero punches. It is. Oh, I don't want to say it's the best 9th edition book we've seen so far. But it's top 5, if not top 3.
We can't just say that everyone is the best one we've seen so far. But it's flavorful.
They're outdoing themselves at the moment, man. Exactly. The flavor, the internal depth. Like, there's no reason not to be excited. Like, if you play any of these factions, I'll say the same thing for Eldari. I'll say the same thing for Custodes. I'll say the same thing for Tau. So much depth, so much to get excited about.
And what a great time to be released just after the balance update, right?
Yeah, that's sweet. 3 to 6 months, baby.
3 to 6 months to go together. Nuts.
Perfectly balanced.
That's all things should be.
Just clear out my competition, boys. Clear it out.
As Mr. A's face goes and gets his trophy shelf cleaned off, he's gonna make some space for all this.
Oh dear.
Seriously, I am. I'm kind of happy that the Tyranid players are going to be getting this, and you'll probably see some models on the table we haven't seen in a bit. And
well, that's exactly why options. I love this. That's exactly what, spot on why I love this internal balance stuff. So for the longest time, prior to Crusher Stampede, you have ballpark? It'd be between 25 and 35 data sheets in that book, yeah?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, and you'd play, since I've been in this game and been active in it, like 4th edition, 5th edition, 7th, 8th, and 9th, you've played with maybe 10 of them. Maybe 10 of them were takeable in any one edition. I'd say just about all of them are takeable in this book. You could play any of them.
I would say, yeah. Ripper Swarms are probably the only one that I just don't ever see table. But with the exception of Ripper Swarms, I actually do not believe there is a bad data slate in here. You'll take over others because of just generally down to points or utility. But I actually don't think there's a bad data slate other than that.
What a statement. It's so crazy to think.
Isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. Well, look, we're definitely going to have to revisit this there. We haven't even clawed the chitinous surface of the High Fleet tendrils and the stratagems and list building. We're going to have to come back to this next week.
Absolutely. Like, list building is, geez.
Yeah.
I
Well, gentlemen, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for everybody listening out there. Please don't forget to leave us a 5-star review, leave us a thumbs up or something, you know, wherever you are, wherever you're listening to this. If you can sprinkle on a little bit of a kudos, we'd certainly appreciate it. And we'll be back next week. We'll be talking more Tyranid stuff. And I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. We'll see y'all.
See ya.
See you later.
Our craft worlds are sentient beings. These hosts are not. Better luck next time, monkeys!